Good evening, one and all. I know the end of August already. Time just whizzes by, especially as you get older. It goes quicker as you get older, I'm sure it does. But I am here, and so is my guest today. Now, with the whole pandemic thing, people have had to revamp over the last year. Regroup their relationships, their whole aspects of their life. It's gone back to war years with people digging like allotments, more people growing vegetables. We've had the whole thing of suddenly people baking their own bread again. People don't realize they don't have to go to a great big office for everybody to do their job. Loads of stuff like that. And one of the other things that people have been, going over is their lives and the aspects of their lives. What do they want? Their relationships, their careers, their goals, etc. A lot of basically soul searching. Well, my guest today, she has, well, basically she's come a long way since LA and Stanford University, and some of that's down to her liking vegetarian food, but we'll get on to that in a minute. But she's really, well, it's going to be hard to explain basically, but she is, what can I tell you about her for a start? That would be a good start, wouldn't it? She wears lots of hats. She's Interfaith Discussions. She's the United Nations Advisory Council on Religion, Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH, WASH Alliance, which is dedicated to clean water, that's the WA, sanitation and hygiene, and loads of other stuff. And well known as a speaker and international, all sorts of stuff, spiritual healer, everything, you name it, she's there leading from the front because that's the way she's been. I better introduce her, haven't I? And I'm going to muck some of this number names up, but I will say it, try it the once, and then I'll just do the first name. On the show today, I have the one and only Sadvi Bhagwati Saraswati. Hi, Sadvi, huh?
That was perfect. You didn't mess that up at all.
Oh,
That
well,
was
that makes a
perfect.
change. It's the simple ones I fuck up.
That was absolutely perfect.
Okay, thank you. As I said, I you started off and you share with us about a lot of this in your new book, Hollywood to the Himalayas, A Journey of Healing and Transformation. You started in LA and then you went to Stanford University. But something happened there. You sort of had a bit of a gap and decided to go to India because you like vegetarian food. Is that right?
Well, yeah, in many ways it really is. Of course, that's the external plot and story. I grew up, as the title of the book makes clear, literally in Hollywood, and really had everything that we are taught one needs in order to be happy, in order to have a successful life. I had all of the opportunity. I grew up in a very privileged situation and home and environment and culture. I had a fantastic education, including having graduated from Stanford University. And I was one of those people who, if you looked at me, you would have said, "This girl's, got it all. Everything looks perfect." And yet, I really was suffering a lot on the inside. I had had a very difficult childhood in a lot of ways, with a lot of challenges, even a lot of trauma. And as I grew into adolescence and into early 20s, I did what so many of us do, which is I tried to deal with that pain of the struggle, of the stress, of the challenges by numbing myself. Whether you look at alcohol or drugs or food or shopping or all of the different things we are addicted to, the goal is always, something to take me out of how this present moment feels. And that was pretty much what my life was like. And by the age of 25, I had gotten quite good at what I think of as managing it, meaning I was managing my pain, I was managing my addiction, I was managing my marriage. I had gotten married right after undergraduate, was managing that and was kind of managing my life. Now, I was not by any means deeply happy or deeply in peace, but I didn't know anyone who was. And I mean, that was never even shown as a goal. The goal was always like, learn to manage your life.
And right.
you get happiness when you go shopping or you go to a party or, yep. you know, the guy you like looks at you or something like right. that. You know, you get a straight A on an exam.
Did you have a feeling at that time that something was missing from your life?
Thought it was me.
Yes,
there definitely was a feeling that something was missing. But Barry, I thought the problem was me.
Right.
I thought that I was somehow not right. That there was something inherently wrong with me. I wasn't good enough. I wasn't right. That I wasn't right. And so, yes, it was missing, but it always felt like a hole in me,
right,
rather than just a hole in the experience that I was having. And so at 25, my husband wanted to go to India. And I agreed, as you said, because I really liked the food. I was just vegetarian and thought, well, at least I'll be able to eat happily. And it's so funny because on the airplane to India, I had this conversation with myself where I was like, this makes no sense. I was in the middle of a PhD program. I was really on track academically. Mm-hmm. And I had just taken this semester off of school to go gallivanting around India with a backpack with my husband when I really had no interest in India. I didn't know anything about India. And the only redeeming thing in my mind was good vegetarian food.
Right.
So we lived in the San Francisco Bay Area. I mean, there was fantastic Indian vegetarian food on our corner. So on the plane there, I realized this makes no sense. And so I took a vow. And that was really the very first of many moments of trusting myself, hearing that inner voice, that inner knowing, that higher self, and actually trusting it. And on the plane, my vow, I said, look, if I'm going all the way to India for something as so seemingly nonsensical as liking the food, it means that there must be another reason, and I just don't know that reason. And so I took a vow that I would keep my heart open in India so that I could find the reason that I was there. And that if I couldn't keep my heart open, I was going to get my little self back to California where, even though I hadn't registered for that semester, you know, I could start my research, I could get practicum units, I could do all sorts of other things. Mm-hmm. So I took a very sincere vow that I would keep my heart open.
I was going to say, I think that's one of the main things, is to be open, to not put up sort of fences or look at things in a negative fashion, to actually be
absolutely
open to take it.
Absolutely. You know, without an open heart, there's almost nothing we really can achieve of value. You know, the word courage, I love this. The word courage actually comes from the same root as the word cœur, meaning heart in French and in so many other languages. Mm-hmm. That same root. So courage is actually moving through the world with an open heart. Courage doesn't mean like I avoid scary situations or I, you know, jump off of bridges or whatever. Courage literally means I move through the world with an open heart.
Right.
And in order to keep the heart open, though, You have to trust. And for me, the dilemma was I didn't trust. I didn't trust myself. I didn't trust my own instincts. I didn't trust the universe. And so for me to actually learn how to trust, which happened when I stood on the banks of the sacred Ganges River. In India, we call the Mother Ganga River.
Mm-hmm.
In the lap of the Himalayas, in Rishikesh, which was the very, very first city we went to on the trip. And I had opened this 500-page Lonely Planet guidebook in Delhi and said, Rishikesh. And so we headed off to Rishikesh, and as soon as we got there, I went down to the river. I didn't even know the river was holy, but I had this extraordinary experience of divine connection and oneness and openness and awareness of the perfection, just the divine perfection of all of creation that included me. I had always thought that it would have excluded me, that, you know, there was something wrong with me. But there I was, part of this divine, perfect creation. And that really, that catapulted or catalyzed the whole spiritual awakening and transformation and unfolding and healing for me, and forgiveness of all of that which had happened.
I was going to ask her, I mean, the whole business of, you know, going into the Ganges and that, was it like a washing away of the pain and anger and stuff like that? Is that how it felt?
It wasn't so much a washing of the way. When I think of washing, I think of that which is on the surface level, like you wash off dirt or you wash off paint. For me, the pain was very deep. And so I could have sat in a river from here until the day I died, and there wouldn't be enough water to get inside me and wash away that pain. But it was a giving of the pain to the river, and it required me to pull from within myself. And this was the instruction that I was given by this incredibly great saffron robed, you know, long hair, long beard, very quintessential, extraordinary spiritual master who I had met when I got there, who had told me that I was supposed to go into the river and give my pain. And while I certainly thought there was no chance in a million years it was ever going to happen, I mean, I was a hardcore academic.
Right.
I was not a mystic. I was not a spiritual person. I was like, you do not give your pain to rivers. You go through processes and lots of processes. But I had such a sense of respect for him and such a sense of awe at the amazingness of the spiritual awakening experience that I had already had, that spiritual transformation, opening and ecstatic oneness that I had had standing on the banks of Ganga, and that realization that I was part of the perfection of the universe, that I thought, well, I don't have anything to lose. The worst that happens is I'm exactly where I am now, so I might as well do it. And so I went into the river, and I literally called forth from within me every aspect of pain that I could. And I held in my mind's eye the perpetrator of that pain and forgave him. I mean, it took a long time. This was not like an in and out of the river.
That's what I was going to ask, whether it was sort of a sudden thing or whether it was something, and the more you went into, and the deeper you went with it, the more you were able to open and do the forgiveness.
Yeah, I don't know how long exactly I was in the river, but I was there a long time. And I cried, and it was an initiation ritual.
Right.
It was not a ceremonial dunk. It was it was an initiation of all sorts. And I was in that river a long time until I could really look at him and really forgive and really pull from within me all of the pain and offer it into the waters. And the river is a really fast flowing river, especially in September, which is when this was, which is right after the monsoon seasons. Yep. And so just to offer it into the river and feel that tug of the river literally pulling it was such an extraordinary experience. And you know, Barry, I can tell you 25 years later, it hasn't come back. I mean, in the beginning, my very psychoanalytically, scientifically trained part of me was like, yeah, that was nice, but I'm sure it didn't actually work. Like, I'm sure it'll be back. I'm sure you'll be suffering just as much next week. And I kept trying. It's so funny. The human mind is so funny. I kept trying to bring it back. I kept trying to find that pain again to convince myself that it hadn't actually been given. But it had.
And you couldn't find it.
25 years later now, it was free. I literally became in that moment free of the way that the pain had kept me chained, free of the identification as the one who had been pained, who had been abused, who had been abandoned, who had been betrayed. There had been such an identification. You know, we all tend to identify as the role we play in our own karmic drama. And so we identify as our relationships, we identify as our careers, we identify as our histories, we identify as that which has happened to us. And I had always identified as that, which is what caused me so much pain. Mm-hmm. And there in the river and there in India, in this incredible ashram, what I really learned was how to not identify, how that isn't me.
Right.
I am. Yes, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. It's okay.
See, who I am is soul, is spirit, is consciousness, is love, is truth. I'm here in the vehicle. We're all here in the vehicles of our own physical incarnation. We have a body. And the body has a size and a shape and a color and a history. But that isn't who we are. That's like saying you are your car. You know, you are the place where your car has reached. Mm-hmm. The body is just a vehicle for the awakening of our soul.
And with that, you know, you've got this new understanding, not yourself, well, just of yourself, but also a new path to happiness and fulfillment and stuff like that. Basically completely gave up everything, and I guess you're now living in India, aren't you?
I have lived there for the last 25 years. I lived there pretty much from the first moment I was there. It was acutely obvious to me that I was meant to be there. But you know, I didn't give up anything. It sounds like I gave up everything because I became a monastic, I became a nun, I am now saffron robe clothed, and as you said, you know, a spiritual leader. But here's what's important. I didn't give up anything.
Right.
What I did was I made the same choice that we all make. Everything we do, Barry, we do because we think it is what holds the greatest possibility for our own happiness. Whether it's going to a pub with our friends, whether it's going to law school so we can become a lawyer, whether it's buying a new sweater, we do it because we think it holds the key to making us happier.
Right.
And whether it's an immediate happiness, like an ice cream cone, or whether it's a longer-term happiness, going to school, getting a degree, to get a career, we all make choices that we believe are going to bring us the greatest happiness. And that's exactly what we're supposed to do. That is our birthright, to experience the fullness of happiness. the difference is that for me, I realized that happiness, that peace, that fulfillment was not going to come in another degree. It wasn't going to come in buying another pair of jeans. It wasn't going to come from acquiring more and more money. I had experienced in those first few months a happiness that I had never in 25 years experienced. And it came from a deep connection to myself, to my higher self, to my deeper self, to the divine. And it came through service,
right,
through serving others, and through all of the volunteer programs, the charitable programs that we run for children, for women. And I realized this holds for me the key to the greatest happiness.
And that's, so, that obviously comes out, you know, in your book, Hollywood to the Himalayas. One of the big things, you know, apart from your obvious joy and the challenges and the experiences and everything like that, is the fact that you're able to, as you said, the Saffron Road person helped you. You're now able to help other people. Not only that, but people who need the nourishment, the peace, the water, as we said, you know, the hygiene and stuff like that. And you know, empowerment as well, I think, for women and girls especially. You're able to guide people to find this better place or better life.
And that has been, it's been such a blessing. And this is the key to life, really, is that we can only give that which we have. We can only be, as St. Francis of Assisi said so beautifully, instruments of peace. When we actually experience peace within ourselves, you know, that beautiful prayer that he gave us of, oh Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace.
Yep. Yep.
And to share and to spread light and healing and love and hope. Well, we can only do that when we have that. And for me, the gift has been to experience the highest and deepest spiritual joy and peace and bliss of knowing the truth of myself, and to be able to share that with others in teaching. And as you speak about the schools and the water, you know, the joy that one can get from actively, thoroughly being engaged in service of others is just infinite. It's one of the highest and fastest and most powerful ways, actually, to have a deep spiritual experience. I talk about a lot of this in my book because we're very anchored in service, and there's a whole beautiful philosophy and teaching and tools around service as a spiritual practice. Because for a lot of people, sitting with their eyes closed and their legs crossed in a room is not easy, and it's a lot easier to get out there and work in a soup kitchen,
right,
or plant trees or teach in a school. And that's great. That is a spiritual practice. But there's a whole teaching of how to do that so that it actually helps us to unfold and blossom and get closer to our truth. So for me, that's been an extraordinarily powerful element of the practice, along, of course, with the very deep and powerful seated with your eyes closed, legs crossed meditation, which I teach a lot of as well. And then to be able to now, 25 years later, to share that with people who are suffering. And that's really why I wrote the book. I mean, 100% of all of the proceeds that come from it go directly to the charitable programs, directly to the women and the girls and the schools and the environmental work. So there's no commercial interest or agenda here at all. It was 100% just to help people all over the world who I've been seeing for 25 years. People are suffering. They have everything, like I had everything in so many ways. And yet inside, we're stressed, we're miserable, we're constantly, you know, jealous and judgmental, We feel like we're not enough. We feel like there's something wrong with us. We're not able to really experience joy and peace and freedom in our lives. And so I thought, well, let me write this book and really share my journey, mm-hmm. which is quite an incredible spiritual adventure, as you know, and it's certainly right. something that will make people laugh and cry and be amazed at what, you know, it's like to live as a celibate monastic in,
right.
in a very traditional religious order. But also to realize that even though their physical life journey is different and they could be living anywhere in the world, the journey of how they think from what you could consider a Hollywood way of thinking, of identifying as this body, this history, this role, this title, this story that keeps us stuck, to a Himalayan way of thinking, which is freedom and love and truth and spirit and soul and consciousness and fullness and wholeness and completeness. That is something that everyone can do, regardless of their religion or their race or their walk of life or where they are in the world. And so that was really the other big motivation to write the book, was to be able to share what I've learned
right.
coming from their world and help them find that, and which it won't take them 25 years because they don't have to learn it as they go along like I did. They'll be able to benefit from all of what I took 25 years to learn.
Well, I know what I've learned, and that's how fascinating, what a wonderful book this must be to go through this, you know, what you've able to not just go through, but to share with everybody in your book, Hollywood to the Himalayas, A Journey of Healing and Transformation. But what I'm going to do now, Sadhvi, is to hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where people can find out more about you and your books and everything else.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Barry. It's been just such a joy and a blessing. And you can find out more at www.hollywoodtothehimalayas.com. That's hollywoodtothehimalayas.com. And you can download some free chapters there. You can see all of the amazing testimonials from everyone, ranging from Jane Goodall to Deepak Chopra to so many in between. And for those of you already who know I need this book, which I hope is most of you, you can actually go straight to Amazon or to your favorite bookseller and order it right there. Just search for Hollywood to the Himalayas. And the Hollywood to the Himalayas website will also take you through the links to my website, to the websites of all of the different charitable programs that we are running as well. So it's kind of a one-stop shopping situation. You can just go there and get all of the information, all of the inspiration, and be sure to just go to Amazon or your favorite bookseller, get the book. And lastly, I wrote this book for you. As I said, I'm not taking one penny from it. It's all going directly to charity. I wrote it for you so that you could find that healing and that transformation, which I've been so blessed with, and which is so accessible and available for you. So as you read it, please, reach out on Facebook, reach out on Instagram, reach out on the website, reach out on YouTube, reach out wherever you feel comfortable, reach out by email, and let me know how you have been impacted and healed and transformed from this book.
Well,
because it is for you.
Thank you, Sadhvi. Gonna have to cut you off because we're running out of time, but thank you so much for being a guest on the show. It's been truly fascinating. Thank you Barry.
It's been such a joy.
Well, there you go, my guest today, Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati. I know, I can't spell it, let alone spell it, I tell you. But as she said, you can find, if you're looking for her, you can find her website, Hollywood to the Himalayas, all one word, Hollywood to the Himalayas. And that's the name of the book, Hollywood to the Himalayas, A Journey of Healing and Transformation. Fascinating and very enlightening, I know. Well, that's it. I'll be back again tomorrow with a fresh show. But until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget... Make sure it's working.